Thank you, and good afternoon. Good to see everybody here. I missed you in Africa. The brethren there give special greetings to the church here in Terre Haute. I'm amazed as to what they really know about the churches, who pastors what, and so forth. And they give special greetings to the churches in Lafayette and Terre Haute. That was just very, very wonderful of them to do that. So I have a lot to say about that. It was a very successful trip. Every objective that we had on this trip, we achieved. I was able to see firsthand how conditions are in Africa. I was absolutely stunned by how terrible they were as far as the medical area. It was just very, very sad to see what is happening there. But, okay, I have far more to talk about than there is time, but I just want to say first that it was a trip that underscored once again the value of human life. For some of us, and it's very easy to just write off people in an area where there's poverty, where there is hopelessness, disease, as there is in Africa, and the countries that I visited, Malawi in particular, is the third poorest country in the world. Only two countries are poorer than Malawi, and that is Lesotho, which is at the very bottom, and that country has its only export is sand. And then the country that's just above Lesotho is Mozambique, and then following that is Malawi. I'm not sure where Zambia comes in, but it's not too far from the very bottom of all countries. But people who live in those countries are people. They have the same feelings that you do. They have the same thought process. They might be a little bit different, but they think. They have physical, emotional, spiritual needs, just like every single one of us do. They have feelings. They love their children. They get jealous, they get envious, they get joyful, they get tearful, they grieve, they rejoice. They're just like you and I are. And they are people who, in God's sight, have the same value that you and I have. In Acts chapter 17, verse 26, I just wanted to mention a few verses here. Acts chapter 17 and verse 26, that references to the creation of human beings and how God has valued them. His meeting with every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their preappointed times and boundaries of their dwellings. God is the one who created all of us from one blood, from Adam and Eve. And from that, the major races have spread. And when we have a brother in Africa, a black brother in Africa who has an income of $17 a month, he is just as much a brother or just as much valued in God's sight as any human being. In Romans chapter 2 and verse 11, for there is no respect of persons with God. In God's sight, everyone has equal value. The people in Malawi, the people in Zambia, the people in Zimbabwe, South Africa, United States. We are not better than anyone as far as ultimate potential as human beings. Life expectancy in Malawi is 36 years. Life expectancy in Zimbabwe is 40 years. In Zimbabwe, every other child born is HIV positive. In other words, they're a living time bomb until they have AIDS. In the next few years, there will be 28 million AIDS orphans. 28 million AIDS orphans. We talk about taking care of the fatherless and widow. Believe me, Africa is the king of the fatherlessness because of AIDS and parents being wiped out and children, many of them having being HIV positive. At the Chande Clinic in Malawi, the secretary at the clinic died of AIDS last year. Before that, her husband died 3 or 4 months before that of AIDS. Since that, the two children they had have died of AIDS. They have a new routine. While I was at the Chande home, the nephew of Mr. Chande had just died a few days before that, age 28, of meningitis. Death is everywhere, and life and birth is everywhere. You see women carrying babies, you see the birth rate, they're asking people to hold down the birth rate. Even at the Chandi Clinic, there's a big poster in their local Chewa language. It shows a family of four people being very happy, but all four are little girls. And it said, four children is enough, even if they are all girls. That's the sign that's there. People wanting their boy says, four children is enough, even if they are all girls. I feel, too, that as Christian responsibility, we have not just a right or not just a privilege to help, but actually a command to help from God, to help those who are less fortunate than we. And I think that this congregation understands that quite well. I do know that we can do a lot, and it doesn't take money, necessarily. There are many different ways in which we can leverage our help. One thing I found with the Chandis, and this was absolutely stunning to me because I did not realize this, their clinic and the condition of it and the way they live is worse than I had imagined. But they have virtually lived off the container, off the things that we had sent on the container last year. And almost everything I saw in the clinic were things that we had packed. The wheelchair in the clinic, the furniture, the desk, the computers, everything that was visible to my eyes in the clinic was put on by us. We had 25-gallon drums of dried milk. They just ran out of that milk. We said, people still coming and ask, are you going to get more powdered milk? While I was at the clinic, a woman came in with her baby. And usually it's a woman who has a baby strapped on her back. Usually sometimes she has two babies. She has a woman, baby strapped on the back and one strapped on the front, and they walk that way. Amazing how they can balance things. And then on top of that, they may carry a suitcase, a whole pile of wood, or whatever. They just walk balanced with two babies. It's just, you never see anything drop or fall. One woman is carrying a whole tray of oranges. She's walking in the streets of Lusaka, and I could not believe it. I have a picture of it. Just walking with a whole tray of oranges and balancing them on her head, just walking down the street like nobody's business. But one woman came in with a baby. The stomach was distended. The ankles were swollen. And Mrs. Chandi, I just followed her through the diagnosis part. The mother was no more than 16 or 17 years old, maybe even younger, I don't know. And the diagnosis, malnutrition. All they eat is maize, ground up corn. There was no milk. There was nothing fresh, very little protein. All it was maize, and that is oftentimes refined. And much of the population is suffering from malnutrition. One thing that we had sent in a container last year was 3 tons of dried soup mix that we had donated to us. We sent over a ton of rice. We sent over a ton of wheat flour, which of course is all gone. But those things hardly cost us anything, and the U.S. Army shipped it. It's just a matter of wanting to do it and making certain that it gets over there. I was happy to bring over the items that the Shepherds had donated. The Shepherds had given us 2 computers, one which put its way to South America, to Santiago, where it's being used by the church there in learning computer skills, and it's being managed by the International Youth Corps. But then I took with me the desktop computer, which was all except the monitor. And Jeff Osborne donated the keyboard to it, and I bought a mouse for it, and we had it all set up, and I packed it. And also they had given me, Mrs. Shepherd, a sphygmomanometer, a blood pressure kit, and a stethoscope. So I brought those to the Chandis, and they were absolutely ecstatic. She doesn't even have that type of blood pressure device that was that good. She had no stethoscope. And she, I have a picture of her with the yellow stethoscope on and a big smile on her face. But they were very, very happy to receive these things. But let me tell you a little bit about getting down there and what we saw. One of the longest flights in the world is nonstop from New York to Johannesburg. And for some reason, I was in some kind of denial. Because it's summer here, and Africa, you hear about it being equatorial, I thought it would be warm there too. I did check, and they said, well, it might be a little bit cool, but they had an unseasonably cold winter. And July 1st is like January 1st here. It was freezing in Johannesburg. There was frost in the cars. Days are short. Sunset was, I believe, 5:20 p.m. in Johannesburg. And on top of that, people don't heat their homes. They just let it go at what it is. And I was freezing much of the time. It was just plain cold in Africa. I was wondering when I had asked Andre Van Belkom, should I bring shorts? He says, oh, no, you won't need them. I understand that very well. I had one sweater warm and a light jacket, so that I'd be all bundled up with a blanket in my room. And the temperature in the room was about 45, 50 degrees. People walk around with sweaters, they adjust to the cool air. Now I know why people want blankets in Africa. Because in the wintertime, you see these squatters' camps everywhere. And these are people who basically camp out, live outside, and they are wrapped in their blankets. I didn't realize just how important it was until you actually see people all bundled up. They just live off their body heat. I arrived on a Thursday afternoon. I was picked up by Andre Van Belkom and another church member. We stayed overnight in Johannesburg, and the next day, Friday, flew to Lusaka, Zambia. Now, South Africa is a country just like this. When you're in South Africa, you sometimes think that you're in California or Indianapolis. It's well-developed traffic. There's just a lot of wealth. Then we flew to Lusaka, which is just a fraction of the life quality that South Africa has. We brought our computer through the nothing to declare section. This is the Chapard computer. But the customs man had his eye on that box. Whenever they see a cardboard box, they over here. So Andre said, well, let me take it. I'll let me go through and answer all the questions. And so I went out. Mr. Banda greeted me. And Andre's not coming out of customs. 15 minutes go by, 20 minutes go by, 25 minutes go by. And then I thought, well, not only is there a computer in there, but it's got a lot of computer disks. It has that blood pressure thing. It's got the everything in there. And he's going to declare it wrong. I said, so I stand back and say, get out of here. Just go back. Everything is okay. So he had negotiated with them and basically was happy to get out with only a $40 payment of duty for the computer. So everything has been free up to that point until we entered to the computer into the country and paid a $40 duty. But that was just fine. Because we went to Mr. Banda's office and plugged it in and it worked. We plugged it in, we had him buy a color monitor for it. Everything worked perfectly. So just tell Denny that it was just fine. I mean, Windows came up, Office came up, and he was beaming with his white teeth from edge to edge. So we're happy that he's able to use it. We went to his office. He is the head accountant for Kariba Minerals. It's a mining company that mines amethyst that is used for making jewelry. And there are only two mines for amethyst in the whole world that are used for jewelry. One in Brazil, and this other one here in Lusaka. Well, it's actually the mine is 250 miles away, but they bring the amethyst in, and then they have people that chip on it, they wash it, they grade it, sort it, and then they send most of it to Hong Kong or to India, where it's all made into jewelry. If you take a look at my website, I've been putting up photos and different illustrations of what we had seen, but we were given a tour of the factory. Then from there we went over to where we had the pre-appointed meeting with Heifer Project International. I had been advised that Heifer Project is a very good organization headquartered in Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas, and that they provide cattle to people who have cattle or host their cattle. Now we have 70 to 90 brethren. We had 48 come to our meeting there on a Sunday that weekend. They lost all their cattle to corridor disease 2 years ago. The disease carried by a tick on the wild African buffalo. Now what people do is that they have community grazing of their cattle. I mean, they just herd all their cattle into a plain and it grazes. The trouble is, it's all together and disease spreads rapidly and killed off all the cattle in central Zambia. Our brethren basically lost a very, very important means of dairy source and draft source, pulling power. Now, for the last 2 years, all the plowing has been done totally by hand with a wife and the children pulling the plow. In Zambia, we did not see one single tractor. The whole country basically subsistence farming. And it's strange. It's not fields. It's just there's trees, and then there's open spaces, a little bit more trees. In the middle of all this, they plant their maize, and they plant their cotton. Those are the two items that they raise, the maize and the cotton. But all of it has been done by hand plowing. With an animal, with a team of oxen, they can plow several times that amount of land, obviously, and be able to take the maize and sell it, and sell more cotton. But right now they have been reduced to what in most African countries, or what in most the impoverished countries, the people raise enough just to get by. And that's the state of our brethren's condition. Heifer Project, we talked to the direct point on email, and also with their head office. We had an appointment in the afternoon, and they explained the program to us. They're willing to work with this group, as a group. They will give them 8 months of education, and they have certain conditions before they will actually give the cattle. First of all, they said no more community grazing because that spreads disease. They said you cannot graze animals that way. You have to agree to our regimen of care. You must build a shelter for every single animal. You must, you know, there's 12 different cornerstones on which this program is based. The first cornerstone is that you must give the first offspring to a needy neighbor. I found this program to be so well thought through, it was almost millennial in how it viewed receiving aid. Because what was important to Heifer Project was not the fact that here are people, now they can get cows. Here are people who can get goats now where they didn't have them and they could just go ahead and do what they want to with them. No, they have to care for them. They have to care for their community. They have to pass on their blessing to others in the community and be concerned about bettering the entire community, not only their own personal status. They have to be accountable, responsible for what they have. They have already given away 4 million heifers in this program. And in China alone, the 1 millionth of the offspring has been passed off to a neighbor. So we are an excellent candidate because we have 12 families living close by. Also, one thing too is that even though they work with a community, they want people to have personal responsibility. You are responsible for that animal. They come and check. They give lectures. And I certainly hope that now we can start rebuilding the herd and basically doubling, tripling their a standard of living. The name, the man, Kwacha Chicheza, who was the country director for HPI, was a Malawian who had escaped Malawi in some political crisis. His father was one of the government leaders in Malawi who ended up on the wrong side of the political spectrum, and so his family fled. So he and Kabani Banda, our elder there, are of the same tribe. They got along very well. So now we're going to, now we have a very good connection of Mr. Banda working with them. Also I found that Mr. Chicheza had lived in Moscow for 7 years in the days of the Soviet Union as a veterinary scientist. He spoke perfect Russian. So here's a Malawian living in Zambia, and here we're chattering away in Russian. It was the most unusual connection. But he was very friendly and very much desirous of us helping. Now, we could also contribute to the project to speed it along by contributing $100 per animal, and they will take the projects as they come to them. But in any event, I feel like we can do a lot to rebuild the herd. When we actually went out to the area of Mumbwa, where these people live, we did see one pair of oxen out there and found out that they had rented those oxen to help start plowing the fields. But we would like to be able to see all of our families have a pair of animals in the next 2 years. And I feel like it's a good way not to just give them to the animals, but to make them responsible, control this, they give them a veterinary kit, they give them different things for making sure that the animals survive. On the Sabbath, one more thing about the country of Zambia. It's a country of 9 million people, and it has 73 languages. 73 languages, actually 6 major languages, and the rest are dialects. But the Chewa, which is in the east, the people of the more Malawian origin, in fact, the African boundaries have been drawn in the 1870s in what was known as the Berlin Conference. And they were not drawn to really consider where the tribes went. They were just drawn with a certain haphazardness as the countries divided Africa colonially. And so you have the Chewas in Malawi and Zambia are the same people, but because of this accord, this Berlin treaty, they found themselves in two different countries. And the people in central Zambia are the Ilo people, and that's who our brethren basically are. It's a language totally different from Chewa. So Mr. Banda, who speaks Chewa, cannot communicate with the brethren directly there, so they use English as the intermediary language. We had services in Lusaka at the home of one of the members. He actually is quite a prominent person. He's the registrar of the Agricultural Developmental College in Lusaka. We had a number of families over, and we had a service that ran for 2.5 hours. They were just so excited to talk, and Andre spoke, and I had spoken. We sang songs, Mr. Banda led in songs, and that evening we took the service in, because he and his wife were celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary. So we took them and Mr. Banda out to dinner. The next morning, Sunday, was one of the big days. This is the drive out to Mumbwa, about 100 miles to the east. You go about 60, 70 miles on a main road, which is the main highway, straight as could be, although it's all beat up, that goes towards Angola. And then you get off about 30, 35 miles onto secondary roads. And believe me, they're very secondary. It took far longer on that secondary road than it did on the main road. But as we left Lusaka, they said, we need to have some coolant. We need to buy some coolant. And Mr. Banda's boss had given him to use that day a Land Rover, so that we wouldn't have to have a small car. And in fact, I don't know how in the world he gets through with a small car, but he goes out there once a month to preach and to take care of the brethren. We had a Land Rover. Well, we got out of town, just leaving town when we see that we stopped the car, and it wouldn't start again. The battery had run down. Well, what's the problem? Well, the broken belt, and we had to fix that. So we got coolant. We went back to his Kariba mineral place because it's a safe place to work on something. You just don't work on things in the open because you can get robbed very easily. We were told to sit tight. People's homes have huge fences and spikes and everything because of the violence. In fact, people don't, at night, stop at red lights. Because if you stop at a red light, you're a sitting duck because bandits are around and they just attack people and cars, etc. So we went back to his place of business where he could open up the hood and replace the belt and headed up. We got out of town a little bit, and all of a sudden, the, this is the first thing that happened. We're going about 50, 55 miles an hour on this road, and all of a sudden the hood flies up on this Land Rover. Cracks the windshield in two places. The hood is mangled into about 800 different shapes in front of us, and so we have a problem. Well, Webster, our driver, we had a driver come along with us, runs into this little settlement, comes up 10, 15 minutes later with some wire. And so we wire the hood down, wired it all over the front, because we couldn't take it off. We had no place to put it. It was just huge. So we started driving, and then all of a sudden, the engine overheats. Overheated. So to get to the radiator, we had to take all that wire off and lift up the hood again. And the driver, for some reason, just quickly opened that. You know, big sprays all over the place. And so we sit there for 20 minutes, half an hour, waiting for it to cool down. So we put in a little bit of coolant, which we had bought that day. But I didn't know what was really in there. We go another 5 miles, it overheats again. Again, we had to take all the wire off and to get underneath. That happened 3 times. So we sent back the driver on a big truck coming the other way back into town to get his car, to get Mr. Carr and catch up with us. Because we really wanted to get out to see the people. I didn't want to turn back. And so he got on this big, cargo, 18-wheeler, and vanished. We did, though, went to Ville, and this is a duck area, needed some water, because we wanted to see what we could fill up. And we got some water and filled the radiator up, and just hoping that there wasn't a leak, that we could go. Then all of a sudden, this man in blue shows up on the road, just because there's people walking around all over the place. This man in blue, we call him our Blue Angel. He comes in and he seems to know about the insides of a Land Rover. He gets in there with a hammer and something else. He says, there's another loose belt here and everything. I mean, there were just all kinds of things were wrong. He loosened up the belts, was happy with that. We wired the hood back down and start heading out towards Mumbwa. And never had overheating problems that day. But our driver, Webster, still, you know, I had to ride back there after ever made it. We got to Mumbwa 3.5 hours late. It took us 6.5 hours to go 110 miles or so. And the children were waiting. They had children as sentries on this road. And as soon as they saw our Land Rover, they shouted to the other kids, and then they all ran back to the village, and, you know, they're here, you know, this is a big event. And we drive in there. But the road from the main road, there were places where it was like a crater. And you come there, and you figure out, how am I going to get through this? Do you go around? Do you go through it? Or just what? So we sit there, make a decision, and then, you know, it was the most unbelievably bad road that I had ever seen. Then you'd end up in a settlement of some sort. The road ends. Where does it start up? Oh, the other side of the settlement. All of a sudden the road starts up again, but you're going through chickens and people and everything you're getting. You go through there and you continue on. At places there was a split in the road. There are no toll, period. And the driver looks, which way do we go, right? I don't know. I'm not from Zambia. But we finally got there. There are some places in Mozambique where they have intentional potholes, where people sit by a pothole, and as you come by, you can't cross it, they say they'll fill it up for you for a fee. And so they fill it up, you pass through it, you pay them through it, then they go dig it out again and wait for the next driver to come by. The top of the Land Rover was open. There were several times we busted our head against the top of the Land Rover, and we come into town, I thought, oh, I better comb my hair, but it was hopeless. It was like a Brillo pad, you know, it was just absolutely just unmanageable. And if you ever heard of ring around the collar in its ultimate, my shirt was so black, you know, from the dirt. And then we come into the village, and there's no chance at all. The doors open, people surround us, they're so happy to see us. They're wearing suits, ties and everything, and we are as grungy as, you know, as could be after 6.5 hours in that Land Rover. They were so happy to see us. But just as we drove in, the leader tells us that his house had burnt down the night before last, on Friday night. His grass home, oil lamp spilled, and it totally burned it up. There it was, right there. And he lost everything in it. He was able to throw out the tape player, the boombox that they had for listening to services. But other than that, he had lost everything. So we figured he lost $500 to $800 worth of furniture and different things. But he and his wife were really, they're still happy. They're still happy to see us. Have box they listen to. They're going through bad so fast that they devised a car battery with a solar panel trickle charger. So they trickle charge this car battery and then they play the tapes for services on the Sabbath. People in this little settlement are all members of the United Church of God, all of them. There's about seven little huts. And then about 7 to 10 miles beyond, there's another grouping of five. And these people come by bicycle to us. And one couple had rented the oxen, they came by ox cart. I mean, they came with a limo. I mean, that was actually, I wish I had that ox cart rather than that Land Rover. I mean, they seemed like they were really kind of riding a lot more conveniently than we had. But one couple that had, one family that came on a bicycle, I have a picture of it, you've got to see it. It shows the husband on the riding the bike. They have one child on the handlebars, one that he's kind of holding on the bar in front of him, and the wife is on the back of this bicycle. Four of them, and they had come 10 miles to services. He's wearing a suit, she's wearing a colorful outfit. The children are as happy as could be. They came to services. There were seven bicycles. They had like a little parking lot there of bicycles. They are in the most atrocious shape. And Andre, last time he had been there, he said one person who was repairing a bicycle inner tube, it had so many patches that there was more patch than there was actual rubber tire around it. He says, get them $3 to get a new tube, you know, for that. But what we want to do for this village, because transportation is an issue to them, is to be able to buy bicycles for 12 families. The bicycles they make there in Lusaka, they're made for that terrain. You would not want to ship anything from here. But they have these kind of rough and ready type bicycles that cost $100 a piece. And I figured that for $1,200 we could provide transportation and make it even so that nobody gets one, nobody doesn't get one. And then the seven beat up bicycles they have could be like their second car, could be for the wife, you know, just like our second car. Oh, pardon me, for the man, for his work vehicle. Okay, better quick one behind on that issue. But anyway, that's what they had for bicycles. We took pictures. By 3 o'clock so that it wouldn't be too late before we got back, because the main highway, they say, is full of bandits, and as it was, we were stopped about seven different times on the way back by police, and it's pitch black, absolutely pitch black, and the police would stop you, they come up to your vehicle with AK-47s, they look in the back of your van, and what they're looking for is maize, they're looking for bags of corn, because they immediately put a tax of about 30 cents a bag for any corn that comes out of the fields into town. That's where they collect the tax. But anyway, the meal was being prepared. They had a grass hut without walls, because the grass top. That was the communal kitchen. And they had pots of different things on rocks. They had sudza, which is like cream of wheat, hardened cream of wheat. That's the corn. And that's their staple. Then the day before, they had killed an antelope, and they had some chickens. And we took some pictures there at the kitchen. And they built themselves a church hall, would you believe? One of the buildings that they built was a community hall in the midst of these seven huts. It has a podium. It's got, you know, walls, doors. It's a public building. It was just heartening to see this building that they had built so they could have services. And this little group of seven huts, along with the other brethren, have this sense of community. This is where they meet. This is where they listen to tapes. This is where the minister, when they come, meets. So we had our meal in the church hall. That's what they basically called it. And Audrey Van Dalkum last time had said, please, would you have the ladies join with us this time? Because before, the women were nowhere to be seen, and the men all eat together. And this time the women were there, but they still were on the other side of the hall. At least they were inside. So Andre was happy with the progress that he was able to see. But most of the cutlery had burned up in the fire. However, they don't use cutlery anyway. They just eat, you know, with their hands. But for Andre and I, somehow they found two big spoons. They're like two huge serving spoons, one for him and one for me. And they brought this sudsa, you know, this big pot of this, and they kind of took the top off, you know, and put that down. And then they came by with three different choices. They said, Mr. Kubik, would you like antelope, chicken, or intestines? I said, well, the first two sound pretty good. You know, I was pretty excited about that. So I had the, I thought intestines means liver and those types of things. So, because Andre had some intestines. And so they kind of poured the gravy on the sudsa, and it was actually quite delicious. We sat there, we talked, and we ate with spoons. Everybody else, as soon as we were served, everybody dove in with their hands, you know, just grabbing chunks of sudsa, you know, boom on the plate, you know, like this, they eat. And that's just the way they eat all the time. So we, after a very delicious meal, we started the service. And, you know, we were still, again, so grungy. And I mean, my shirt on the inside was just pitch black. And, you know, we both had messages. It was cool out there. You know, it was just chilly. There's always a breeze blowing. And we have a breeze blowing at about 55 degrees. It's cool. And, you know, we just came from the northern hemisphere down there. And they were, you know, they're wrapped pretty much in clothing pretty well. So I had given a sermon. Andre did. We went about a couple hours with our total service. And then afterwards, we just walked around the village. And then the head man came. Now, they have hierarchical structure in the country where they have these head men. And we were told by the Heifer Project International people, don't mess with the head man. That if you want to have a successful Heifer Project, you've got to make peace with the head man. You've got to have his blessing. You've got to bring him into the whole thing. Well, of course, he saw the Land Rover come in, and he lived in a settlement beyond, which is maybe about a mile or so. And he came over, and he sat down, and we started talking to him a little bit and just making friends and telling him, you know, what we're wanted to do and so forth. And he kind of listened. And then afterwards, I took his picture. And just before we left, he says, do you have anything for the head man? Well, that means money. So I gave him $10. Somebody says, you gave him far too much. So that's a half a month's wages that you gave him. I says, well, I said, we've got a Heifer Project coming up. You know, we want to be friends with him. Well, he had already been to Andre Van Dalkum too. And but from Andre, he was asking for bullets. He says, I want bullets because he likes to hunt. So Andre didn't have any bullets with him just right then, but said that he would provide him with bullets if necessary. During the service, you know, we're sitting here, and there's about three or four women breastfeeding their babies right there, you know, in front of me. And they'll, you know, through the whole service. And that cured me of any distractions from children, believe me, for a long, long time. I mean, just had to kind of, you know, work through that. We went back to Lusaka, and then the next day we flew up to Kitwe, where we have another member who lives. He had not seen anybody in the church since the Feast of Tabernacles last year. He goes to South Africa for the feast. But he's kind of the office for the Zambia-Malawi area. He and his wife, they operate an electrical fence business, and they build electrical fences around power plants and homes and that sort of thing. And they are sort of in the pre-retirement stage to where they bought a 30-acre farm, and they completely electrified it the outside. They said they'd love to have a telephone there, but every time that they have put a telephone in, somebody steals the copper wires just outside their house. And it happened over and over again, so they have a cell phone. But we brought them a computer as well, and they received the good news in a box, and then they send them out to 90 addresses in Malawi and to about 60 addresses in Zambia. And it's growing at a very, very good rate. But we had a most enjoyable evening. They are refugees from Zimbabwe. He fought in the Rhodesian War with Ian Smith, in Smith's government, against the Mugabe's forces, who's the president of Zimbabwe right now. And he talked all about the stories about them on patrols at night and about that protracted war that ultimately ended with Rhodesia becoming Zimbabwe and the capital's name being changed from Salisbury to Harare, and it was under the control of the blacks. But we had a most enjoyable evening with them. They're very, very dedicated people. We talked, we built a bonfire outside, and I'd asked her to wash my sweater out because it was so grungy. That's the only sweater I had. It's the only piece of warm clothing I had. So she washed it out, but then we sat by the fire all night long, so it got full of smoke. So, but it was good, you know. It's kind of camping all the time. I have all these summer shirts that, you know, look terrible. It's like being in the middle of wintertime and looking at summer clothing. It just doesn't do anything for you. Then the next day we flew back to Lusaka and then up to Malawi, which is about an hour flight. They're close by, Lusaka and Lilongwe. And the Chandis came out to meet us. That was such a wonderful reunion to see them. He came, and also another doctor came who has just come to the United Church of God. He had been in the church for years and has dropped out for 4 years, and Andre and I have been in touch with him. He's 72 years old. He was trained in Paris. He's a medical doctor, and he actually is building a clinic that he wants his son to run. That's way in the south of Malawi. And I find out that Mr. Chande and him have been friends ever since childhood. Mr. Chande is 67 years old, Mrs. Chande is 61, and this doctor, Dr. Sam Chilapora, is 72. We went out to the Chande home. They had a very nice meal for us. Everybody's used to eating with their hands, and one of the things that you do before you go through the line for the food, kind of like a buffet, that they come with a bowl and with a kettle of, you know, pretty warm water, and you wash your hands because you'll be eating with your hands. Of course, you know, we weren't used to that, so we used a fork or a spoon. They didn't have forks, they had spoons. And we talked to them that evening. Again, everything is chilled. Windows have no screens. Windows are open, and there's just a constant breeze that blows through, and it's just constantly cool. And I just began to understand why the people need the blankets that they were talking about. We went out to the clinic to take a look at that, and the clinic was far worse than I had imagined. They are renting an old theater, like a little mini theater, and the reception room for the clinic is the theater part. It's very disproportionate. Three-quarters of the clinic is the reception room. And then there's two tiny rooms in back. One is called the consultation room, which is tiny, and just across from it is the treatment room. Mr. Chande works in the consultation room where he talks to the patient or talks to the person who's come in. And it's always a mother with a baby strapped on her back. The whole time we were there, 3 or 4 days, there's mother with baby on her back, one after another. And then Mrs. Chande works in the treatment room. And here's this big tub, like the ones we use for Passover, those plastic things full of needles in it. And they were one-time use needles that were being boiled to be used over again. And I said, boy, you use these needles, well, we try not to. But they are desperate for these regular supplies. And so now I got a much better idea of the types of things that they really, really need. They need syringes, as many as we can get them. They need they need milk powder. They need these anything that's protein boosting. I'm trying to work on having a soy type of product shipped there, but they are desperately in need of it. And they have basically run out of medicine. And you go there for a diagnosis, they'll tell you what's wrong with you, but they can't do anything for you. And that's the way it is in many of the clinics around town. There is no medicine available. On July 5th, we arrived there on July 4th. On July 5th, we had the groundbreaking for the new clinic. And they bought a plot of land about 200 feet from where they're currently at. And it's a very primitive area of town. I mean, just outside of that, there are these people just laying on the ground, and they're selling peanuts or they're selling some kind of fruit. You just can see a long line like a bazaar outside. But we had the groundbreaking. We had a wheelbarrow. Me and Mr. Chande, the four of us, were just dishing in some dirt into the wheelbarrow, symbolic of the start of the new clinic. People all around, the people wondering what we're doing, and they want to get into the picture, you know, just kind of forcing themselves into the picture. And I said, look, we'll take one with you too, but we'll take one without you as well. And then there were people behind me with the camera, all shouting and waving, and I turn off my camera, they're all shouting and waving, so I just take more pictures of them. The people are so open and so happy. And one thing with working with the black people, I find that they work together among themselves better than most people that I have worked with. For example, Mr. Chande and Dr. Chilapora. You know, I thought, well, we're helping Mr. Chande, but what about Dr. Chilapora? And I asked Mr. Chande, he says, we shared some of the things in the last container because we couldn't use some of this, we couldn't use some of that, and we have known each other as friends. They share, they work together exceptionally well. I was just very pleased with that. And just among themselves, they seem to be very open, very giving, and working with each other. Also, some of the things that we shipped in the container, they had such a volume of that, I mean, we shipped 20 tons of things, that they even donated some of the, we had 3 tons of soup mix, dried soup mix. They donated some of that to a local orphanage, which gave them favor with the orphanage. That orphanage will help them perhaps support the clinic. Everybody comes out ahead. We went out to Lake Malawi, which is a lake that's 500 miles long. It's part of that Great Rift Valley in Africa. And we went there to meet a doctor of another clinic who we co-opted with and work. He just really wanted to meet with us. He had a clinic way up north in Mzuzu. But he came down and we came out to the lake and we talked a little bit. And also we baptized one of the Malawians in Lake Malawi, which is an absolutely beautiful lake. It's very narrow. It's only 10, 15 miles wide, but 500 miles long. And you see the shores and the mountains of Mozambique on the other side, and then we were on the Malawi side. From Malawi, we flew down to Harare, Zimbabwe. Now, Zimbabwe's been in the news. We've seen pictures of blacks running off white farmers. We've seen pictures of violence. And I was a little bit concerned about Harare. That was one of the most refreshing places on the whole trip. It was so far ahead economically of both Zambia or Malawi that it was just enjoyable to be there. And the streets are not potholed. There's curbs. Everything seems to be much more orderly. The downtown Harare has big office buildings. You see all the big firms in the U.S. there, Federal Express, and Mobil Oil, and you see just a lot of wealth in the city of Harare. Of course, all the white people thing is all going downhill very fast, but just in comparison to where we had just come from, it was a big relief. We stayed at the home of one of the members, the Heathcotes, and we had a service last Sabbath in town. We had 14 people there for the Sabbath service. Again, we went about 2.5 hours. I just had a very, very enjoyable time. They wanted to, they have so little contact with ministers and with other brethren. There's 14 people that come on an island by themselves and almost get fewer visits than really we are able to provide for the people in Estonia. But they were very happy, and that evening, Saturday night, we had a social, a dinner, and just spent the night talking. On Sunday, we flew back to Johannesburg on Sunday afternoon, and we're taking lunch at the airport and met with the Johannesburg church. About 35 people were there out of the 50 that normally meet, and we had a Bible study for, again, a couple of hours, and then a get-together at the home of the De Camposes, one of the leading members. The Johannesburg church does not have a minister, and Mr. De Campos, George De Campos, takes care of that congregation. He's the one that Mr. Van Belkom has helped him with that particular church. In seeing what I had seen, it gave me a better perspective, and I thought I had a good perspective, but not until you actually see where you do provide the help. The importance of helping people in a proper way. We can help people effectively and fairly and meaningfully. There's several things in helping people that is so important. It's got to be, first of all, fair. It's got to be help that really is help, that doesn't prefer one over another. It has to be very carefully measured out. I felt like with Heifer Project International, where they helped the people themselves be involved in the help process, such as this in the care of the animals. They have got to want to be helped, and they have got to want to help themselves. Also, it's got to be the kind of help that they need, not the kind of help that you think they need, but really find out what is it that will improve their status. For example, to the people in Mumbwa, their cattle is so important to them. Before their cattle all died, they have a close relationship personally with the cattle itself. They call each one by name. It's like part of the family. And one of the biggest negotiations that takes place at the time of a marriage is, how are you going to be using the cows? And in order to have the daughter be given in marriage, a dowry has to be paid. And usually the family of the grooms figures out, well, okay, is she like one cow girl, or is she not a two cow girl, or what? Now, what is she exactly? And so then that cattle becomes part of this marriage agreement. And their cattle was so important to them. And we are trying to rebuild basically an economic structure using the help of Heifer Project International in Lusaka. And I'm confident that for the next 2-3 years that we will do just that. Our goal is to provide every family, each of the 12 units, with 2 head of cattle, which will be for dairy, it will be for plowing their fields. It's important to help people in such a way that culturally it works there. For us, for example, to buy them a car, for example, or a tractor in the middle of a culture that doesn't even see one would be so wrong. The way to help them is to help them with those types of things that keep them in their community as normal, as the norms of their community. But also, as Heifer Project works, they already pre-build into the program the need to expand their blessing to others in the community, because they understand that goodwill and spreading and sharing and caring in that way is vitally important for the life of that community. And that's what we want to accomplish in that area. So we want to work in 2 countries, basically, Malawi and Zambia, and have those as 2 separate projects. The clinic, working with the Chandes and the Malakia Birthing Center and Clinic, where our goal there is to be shipping medical supplies by container, shipping blankets, food by U.S. Army containers, to help them make this clinic a jewel in that community, to where they can help others at very small expense to us, because much of that will be taken care of by funding from others. For example, for the clinic cost total is $20,000. We have already collected $13,500 or so for that clinic. We still have another $6,500 to go. Mr. Chande, I wired him $4,000 yesterday so he could buy the original materials. He has a very good blueprint, which I'll show you to those who would like to see it here after services, for the clinic. He is using a contractor that built his house about 6-7 years ago to build a clinic. Mr. Chande will buy the materials himself. He already has in mind what type of metal sheathing for the building. We have Mr. Tom Piney, an elder in our Lafayette congregation, who wants to help with air conditioning. And we want to have some of the pharmacy inside the clinic and the rooms where the birthing process takes place also to have air conditioning because it gets very hot there in the summertime. So we want to build that. Also, it was interesting that while we were there with Mrs. Chande, in walks this gentleman into the house. And it's every night they have a hymn sing at their house. They get the church hymnal out, and they sing 3, 4, 5 hymns. And with us there, they just did it as well. So we all sang hymns. But in walks this man. They don't stop. He just kind of listens to them. It's her brother, Sam Bonta. And he talks and talks. And in the course of the conversation, I find out that he's a member of the Malawian Parliament. He's part of the government. I said, Mrs. Chande, how come you didn't tell me about your brothers? Oh, that's a secret, she says. But it's good to have a person like that. However, being a member in the government can be a blessing or could be a very big curse. He says his problem is that he's in the opposition party. And he's been to jail 7 times. Because when the government wants to kind of slow things down in the process of dissent or whatever, they just put people in prison. And then they sit there for 2-3 months until their thinking straightens out, and then the government continues. And that's just the way it's done over there. But he was extremely happy about the building of the clinic. We're hoping the clinic will be completed by next spring. And we're hoping, with him, that the Minister of Health can be there for the opening and the dedication of the clinic. And I feel like that's a great tribute to all of you who have worked together to make it happen, to make it a project that will bring good to that group. The church in Malawi is growing at a very good rate. We baptized one more person. There's another one that Mr. Van Belkom talked to about baptism. There'll be a group of about 14 or so that will be coming down from Malawi to Zimbabwe for the Feast of Tabernacles, which is a 10-hour bus ride. That'll be coming there. So with a group in Zambia and Malawi, we have actually very good growth and a lot of enthusiasm for the church. So continue to pray for these areas. I have truly appreciated this trip from the standpoint that I was able to see and assess and really go on from here with the different programs that we have. Because from here on out, there'll be direct benefits to these people that, done in a proper way, can help these people improve their lot from being impoverished and at subsistence level to come to a point of where they can be a little bit more prosperous and be able to sell more maize, sell more cotton, improve their lot in life. Okay, Rick.